Chapter 7. Mengetta. Sleep, when deep enough, is indistinguishable from vigilance. Serenus, The Book of Circles and Spirals. Early summer, 4111, year of the Tusk, the plains of Mengetta. Broad black wings outstretched, the Synthes drifted on the early morning wind, just savoring the curious familiarity of it all. The eastern skyline gradually brightened, then suddenly the sun cracked the horizon, lancing between the hills, over the corpse-strewn expanse of the battle plain, and out into the infinite black, where it would eventually trace a thread incomprehensibly long, perhaps all the way home. Who could blame it for indulging in nostalgia? To be here again after millennia, at the place where it had almost happened, where men and non-men had almost flickered out forever. Almost. Alas. Soon enough. Soon enough. It lowered its small human head and studied the patterns the innumerable dead had sketched across the plains, marveling at the resemblances to certain sigils once prized by its species, back when they could actually be called such. Genera, species, race. In Koroi, the vermin had called them. For a time it wondered at the sense of depth generated by the thousands of slow circling vultures below, each sinking to the feast. Then it caught the scent it had been searching for, that otherworldly fetor, so distinctive, encoded in case of just such a contingency. So Sarcellus was dead. Unfortunate. At least the Holy War had prevailed, over the Kisharum, no less. Golgotharoth would approve. Smiling, or perhaps scowling, with tiny human lips, the old name swooped down to join the vultures in their ancient celebration. The distances writhed, twisted with maggot-white forms draped in human skins, with shrank, shrieking shrank, thousands upon thousands of them, clawing black blood from their skin, gouging themselves blind. Blind! The whirlwind roared through their masses, tossing untold thousands into orbit about its churning black base. Mog Farao walked. The great king of Kyrenius clutched Seswatha about the shoulders, but the sorcerer could not hear his cry. Instead, he heard the voice, uttered through 100,000 shrank throats, flaring like bright burning coals packed into a skull. The voice of the no-god. What do you see? See? What could he? I must know what you see. The great king turned from him, reached for the heron spear. Tell me. Secrets. Secrets. Not even the no-god could build walls against what was forgotten. Seswatha glimpsed the unholy carapace shining in the whirlwind's heart, a nimal sarcophagus sheathed in choric script, hanging. What am? A Commian woke with a howl, his hands cramped into claws before him, shaking. But there was a tender voice, shushing, cooing reassurances. Soft hands caressed his face, stroked sweaty hair from his eyes, daubed tears from his cheek. Esme. He lay in her arms for a long while, periodically shuddering, straining to keep his eyes open, to see what was here, now.
I've been thinking of Kellis, she said after his breathing had settled.
Did you dream of him? A Commian half-heartedly teased. He tried to clear his voice of phlegm. Esmenet laughed.
No, you fool.
What do you see?
A shrieking chorus, sharp and brief. He shook his head.
Sorry?
He said, laughing uneasily.
What did you say?
I must have sleep in my eyes and ears.
I said, just thinking.
About what? Somehow, he could feel her cock her head, the way she always did when struggling to articulate something that eluded her.
About the way he speaks. Haven't you?
I cannot see.
No,
he wheezed.
Never noticed.
He coughed violently.
That, she said, is what you get sitting on the smoky side of the fire.
One of her traditional admonitions.
Old meat is better smoked.
His traditional reply. He squeezed sweat from his eyes.
Anyway, Kellis,
she continued, lowering her voice.
Canvas was thin and the camp crowded. With everyone whispering about him because of the battle and what he said to Prince Sabon, it struck me.
Tell me.
Before falling asleep, that almost everything he says is either, well, either near or far.
Akamian swallowed, managed to say,
How do you mean?
He needed to piss.
Esmanet laughed. I'm not sure. Remember how I told you how he asked me what it was like to be a harlot? You know, to lie with strange men? When he talks that way, he seems near, uncomfortably near, until you realize how utterly honest and unassuming he is. At the time, I thought he was just another rutting dog.
What am I?
The point, Esme?
There was an annoyed pause.
Other times he seems breathtakingly far when he talks. Like he stands on some remote mountain and can see everything, or almost everything.
She paused again, and from the length of it, Akamian knew he had bruised her feelings. He could feel her shrug.
The rest of us just talk in the middle somewhere, while he... And now this, seeing what happened yesterday, before it happened, with each day...
I cannot see.
He seems to talk a little nearer and a little farther. It makes me... Akka, you're trembling, shaking. He gasped for breath.
I can't stay here, Esme.
What do you mean?
This place, he cried. I can't stay here.
Shh, it'll be all right. I heard soldiers talking last night about moving come today, away from the dead, from the chance of vapors, and...
Tell me.
Akamian cried out, struggled to retrieve his wits.
Shh, Akka, shh. Did they say where?
He gasped. Esmanet had kicked free her blankets to kneel naked over him, palms on his chest. She looked worried, very worried. They said something about ruins, I think.
Even worse.
What do you mean?
This place is shaking me to pieces, Esme.
Echoes. Echoes. Remember what I said to Sabon last night? The no-god. His echo is too strong here. Too strong. And the ruins, that would be the city of Mangetta, where it happened, where the no-god was struck down. I know this sounds mad, but I think this place recognizes me. Me or Seswatha within me. So what should we...
Tell.
Leave. Camp in the eastern hills, overlooking the battle plain. We can wait for the others there.
Her expression darkened with other worries.
Are you sure, Akka? We'll be safe. We just need to be far for a while.
With the accumulation of power, Akamian had once said, comes mystery. An old Nilnameshi proverb. When Kellis had asked what the proverb meant, the schoolman had said it referred to the paradox of power, that the more security one exacted from the world, the more insecure one became. At the time, Kellis had thought the proverb yet another of Akamian's vacant generalizations, one that exploited the world-born propensity to confuse obscurity with profundity. Now he wasn't so sure. 5 days had passed since the battle. The last of the sun had boiled away among the western hills. The great names, including Confis and Kefaramuni, had gathered with their retinues in an overgrown amphitheater that had been excavated in ancient times from the side of a low hill. An enormous bonfire burned in its center, transforming the stage into a hearth. The great names sat and conferred around the amphitheater's lowest tier, while their advisors and caste noble countrymen bickered and jested on the tiers above. Their ceremonial dress, much of it looted, glinted and shimmered in the firelight. Their faces shone pale orange. Before them, bare-chested slaves marched from the darkness to the stage, where they cast furniture, clothing, scrolls, and other worthless items from the Kianine camp onto the bonfire. A strange iron-blue smoke whipped skyward from the flames. Its smell was offensive, reminiscent of the manual unguents used by the Yatwurian priestesses. But there was nothing else to burn on the battle plain. At long last, the holy war was entire. Earlier in the afternoon, the Nansur and Ainani hosts had filed across the plains and joined the vast encampment beneath the ruins of Mangetta, a once great city, Akamian had told Kellis,
destroyed during the early age of bronze. For the first time since faraway Momum, a full council of the great and lesser names had been called. Even though his rank and notoriety had earned him a place among those sitting above the great names, Kellis had elected to sit with the knights, men-at-arms, and followers massed on the heaped mounds of earth and rubble opposite the amphitheater, where he could cultivate his reputation for humility and easily survey the expressions of all those he must conquer. For the most part, their faces exhibited startling contrasts. Some bore marks, bandages, puckered wounds, and yellowing bruises of the recent battle, while others bore no marks at all, particularly among the newly arrived Nansur and Einani. Some were flushed with celebratory cheer, for the back of the heathen had been broken, while others were ashen with horror and sleeplessness. Victory on the battle plain, it seemed, had carried its own uncanny toll. Ever since setting their pallets and mats across the plains of Mangetta, various men and women of the Holy War had complained of suffering brutal nightmares. Each night, they claimed, they found themselves in desperate straits on the battle plain, striving against and falling before foes they'd never seen before. Archaic Nansur, true desert Kianin, Kanaan infantrymen, ancient Shigeki chariots, bronze-armored Kyranians, stirrupless Skilvendi, Srank, Basrags, and even, some had insisted, Raku, dragons. When the encampment was moved clear of the carrion winds to the ruins of Mangetta, the nightmares had only intensified. Some began claiming they'd dreamed of the recent battle against the Kianin, that they were burned anew by the Kishorim, or that they fell to the battle-maddened Thunieri. It was as though the ground had hoarded the final moments of the doomed and counted and recounted them each night on the ledger of the living. Many tried to stop sleeping altogether, especially after a Tidoni Thane was found dead one morning in his pallet. Some, like a Commian, had actually fled. Then the pitted knives, coins, shattered helms, and bones started to appear, as though slowly vomited from the earth. At first, here and there, found jutting from the turf in the morning, and in places men insisted they couldn't have been missed. Then more frequently, after stubbing his toe, one man allegedly found the skeleton of a child beneath the rushes of his tent. Kellis himself had dreamt nothing, but he'd seen the bones. According to Gotian, who'd explained the legends regarding the battle plain in private council 2 days earlier, this ground had imbibed too much blood over the millennia, and now, like over-salted water, had to discharge the old to accommodate the new. The battle plain was cursed, he said, but they needn't fear for their souls so long as they remained resolute in their faith. The curse was old and well understood. Proyas and Gothjalk, neither of whom suffered dreams, were loath to leave, both because the couriers they'd sent to Confis and Kefaramuni had named Mangetta as their point of rendezvous, and because the streams running through the ruined city afforded the only expedient supply of water within a 3-day march. Saban also insisted they stay, though for reasons Kellis knew entirely his own. Saban did dream. Only Scaled had demanded they leave. Somehow the very ground of battle had become their foe. Such contests, Zynemus had remarked one night about their fire, belonged to philosophers and priests, not warriors and harlots. Such contests, Kellis had thought, simply should not be. Ever since learning the desperate details of the Enrithi triumph, Kellis had found himself beset with questions, quandaries, and enigmas. Fate had been kind to Coethus Saban, but only because the Galeoth prince had dared punish the Shrial Knights. By all accounts, Gotian's catastrophic charge against the Kishorim had saved the earls and thanes of the Middle North. Events, in other words, had unfolded precisely as Kellis had predicted. Precisely. But the problem was that he hadn't predicted anything. He'd merely said what he needed to say to maximize the probabilities of securing Saban and destroying Sarcellus. He'd taken a risk. It simply had to be coincidence. At least this was what he'd told himself. At first. Fate was but one more world-born subterfuge, another lie men used to give meaning to their abject helplessness. That was why they thought the future a whore, something who favored no man over another. something heartbreakingly indifferent. What came before determined what came after. This was the basis of the probability trance. This was the principle that made mastering circumstance, be it with word or sword, possible. This was what made him Dunyane, one of the conditioned. Then the earth began spitting up bones. Wasn't this proof that the ground answered to the tribulations of men, that it was not indifferent? And if earth wasn't indifferent, then what of the future? Could what came after actually determine what came before? What if the line running between past and future was neither singular nor straight, but multiple and bent, capable of looping in ways that contradicted the law of before and after? Could he be the harbinger, as a Kamian insisted? Is this why you've summoned me, Father, to save these children? But these were what he called primary questions. There were so many more immediate mysteries to be interrogated, so many more tangible threats. Such questions either belonged to philosophers and priests, as Zynemus had said, or to Anassarimber Moengus. Why haven't you contacted me, Father? The bonfire waxed brighter, consuming a small library of scrolls the slaves had hauled from the darkness. Even though Kella sat apart, he could feel his position among the caste nobles arrayed before him. It was like a palpable thing, as though he were a fisherman manning far-flung nets. Every glance, every watchful stare was noted, categorized, and retained. Every face was deciphered. A knowing look from a figure sitting among Proyas's caste nobles, Palatine Gaedeki. He's discussed me at length with his peers, regards me as a puzzle, and thinks himself pessimistic as to the solution. But part of him wonders, even yearns. A look from one of the Tidoni, a momentary meeting of eyes, Earl Kerjula. He's heard the rumors, but remains too proud of his own battlefield deeds to concede anything to fate. He suffers the nightmares. A passing glance from behind Icuri Confis, General Martimus. He's heard much about me, but is too preoccupied to truly care. From among the Thunieri, a fiery-haired warrior searching for someone among the crowd, Earl Gokin. He's heard almost nothing of me. Too few Thunieri speak different tongues. A contemptuous glare from among the Conryans, Palatine Ingaiaban. He discusses me with Gaedeki, argues that I'm a fraud. My relationship to Neyur is what interests him. He too has stopped sleeping. A steady, fixed look from among Gotian's diminished retinue. Sarcellus. One of what seemed a growing number of inscrutable faces. Skin spies, a Kamian had called them. Why did he stare? Because of the rumors, like the others? Because of the horrific toll his words had exacted on the Shrial Knights? Gotian, Kellis knew, struggled not to hate him. Or did he know that Kellis could see him and had tried to kill him? Kellis matched the thing's unblinking gaze. Since his first encounter with Skaos on the Andiamine Heights, he'd refined his understanding of their peculiar physiognomy. Where others saw blemished or beautiful faces, he saw eyes peering through clutched fingers. So far, he'd identified 11 of the creatures masquerading as various powerful personages, and he had no doubt there were more. He nodded amiably, but Sarcellus simply continued watching, expressionless, as though unaware or unconcerned that what he stared at was staring back. Something, Kellis thought. They suspect something. There was a small commotion in his periphery, and turning, Kellis saw Earl Athgieri pressing his way through the crowded spectators, climbing toward him. Kellis bowed his head appropriately as the young caste noble approached. The man reciprocated, though his declension fell slightly short. "Afterward," Athgieri said. "I need you to come with me afterward. Prince Sabon." The striking chestnut-haired man worked his jaw. Athgieri was someone Kellis knew, who understood neither melancholy nor indecision, which was partly why he thought this errand demeaning. As much as he admired his uncle, he thought Sabon was making too much of this impoverished prince from Atrathau, far too much. So much pride. "My uncle wants to meet," the earl said as though explaining a lapse. Without further word, he began pressing his way back to the amphitheater. Kellis looked out over the crowds below to the great names. He glimpsed Sauban, nervously looking away. His anguish grows. His fear deepens. For 6 nights now, the Galeoth prince had assiduously avoided him, even in those councils where they shared seats about the same fire. Something had happened on the field, something more grievous than losing kinsmen or sending the Shrial Knights to their doom. An opportunity. Sarcellus, Kellis noticed, had left his seat on the tiers and now stood with a small party of Shrial priests preparing to assist Gotian in the inaugural rites. The general rumble of voices trailed. The Grand Master began with a purificatory prayer Kellis recognized from the tractate. Then he spoke for some time of Inri Sejanus, the latter prophet, and what it meant for men to be Inrithi.
"Whosoever repents the darkness in their heart," he quoted from the Book of Scholars, "let him raise high the tusk and follow."
To be Inrithi, he reminded them, was to be a follower of Inri Sejanus. And who followed more faithfully than those who walked in his holy steps?
"Shaima,"
he said in a clear, far-traveling voice.
"Shaima is near, very near, for we have traveled farther in one day with our swords than we have in 2 years with our feet."
"Or our tongues,"
some wit cried out. Warm laughter.
4 nights ago," Gotian declared, "I sent a scroll to Mathanet, our most holy shrier, exalted father of our holy war."
He paused, and all was silence, save the cracking of the bonfire. He still wore bandages about both hands, which had been burned by dragging the fallen through fiery grasses.
"Upon that scroll," he continued, "I wrote but one word, for my fingers still bled."
Sporadic shouts broke from the masses. The charge of the Shrial Knights had already become legend.
"Triumph!"
he cried. Triumph. The men of the Tusk exploded in exultation, howling and wailing, some even weeping. Shadowy beneath the stars, the mounds and debris of surrounding Mengeta shivered. But Kellis remained silent. He glanced at Sarcellus, who had his back partially turned toward him, and noticed discrepancies. Smiling, resplendent in firelight and gold and white, Gotian waved for the masses to settle, then called on them to join him in the temple prayer.
"Sweet God of gods who walk among us, innumerable are your holy names."
Words uttered through 1,000 human throats. The air thrummed with an impossible resonance. The ground itself spoke, or so it seemed. But Kellis saw only Sarcellus, saw only differences. His stance, his height and build, even the luster of his black hair, all imperceptibly different. A replacement. The original copy had been killed, Kellis realized, just as he'd hoped. The position of Sarcellus, however, had not. His death had gone unwitnessed, and they'd simply replaced him. Strange that a man could be a position.
"For your name is truth, which endures and endures forever and ever."
After completing the purificatory rites, Gotian and Sarcellus withdrew. Stiff in their ornamental hauberks, the Gilgalic priests then rose to declare the battle celebrant, the man whom Dread War had chosen as his vessel on the field 5 days previous. The masses fell silent in anticipation. The selection of the battle celebrant, Zynemus had complained to Kellis earlier that day, was the object of innumerable wagers, as though it were a lottery rather than a divine determination. An older man, his square-cut beard as white as hoarfrost, stepped to the forefront of the others. Kumor, the high cultist of Gilgeol. But before he could begin, Prince Skeelt leapt to his feet and cried,
"Wiat fearlik pior kaflang dau hara mausrot."
He whirled from the great and lesser names to those massed about Kellis, his long blonde hair and beard spilling from shoulder to shoulder.
"Wiat dauhara mut kaflinga, kaflinga!"
Kumor sputtered something indignant and unintelligible, while everyone else turned to Skeald Stunieri for explanation. His translators, it seemed, were nowhere to be found.
"He says,"
One of Gothyalk's men finally shouted in Shaik from the highest tiers,
that we must first discuss leaving this place, that we must flee.
The humid air suddenly buzzed with competing shouts, some accusatory, others crying out assent. Skyelt's monstrous groom, Yalgrota, jumped to his feet and began beating his chest and roaring threats. The shrunken, shrunk heads about his waist danced like tassels. Inexplicably, Skyelt began kicking at the ground. He crouched with his knife, then stood, raising something against the bonfire's glare. Hundreds gasped. He held a skull, half choked with dirt, half crushed by some ancient blow.
Weat,
he said slowly.
Dau hara mutka flinga.
The dead surfacing like the drowned.
How, Kellis thought, could this be possible?
But he needed to stay focused on practical mysteries, not those pertaining to the ground. Skeelt tossed the skull into the bonfire, glared at his fellow great names. The debate continued, and one by one they acquiesced, though Kefiramuni at first refused to credit the story. Even the exalt general conceded without complaint. Over the course of the debate, some looks wandered toward Kellis, but no one solicited his opinion. After a short time, Proyas announced that the Holy War would leave Mengeda and her cursed plains come morning. The men of the Tusk rumbled in wonder and relief. Attention was once again yielded to aging Kumor, who, either because he was flustered or dreaded further interruptions, dispensed with the Gilgalic rites altogether and came directly to stand over Sabon. The other priests seemed more than a little disconcerted.
Kneel, the old man called out in a quavering voice.
Sabon did as he was told, but not before sputtering.
Gotian, he led the charge.
It is you, Quaitha Sabon,
Kumor replied, his tone so soft that few, Kellis imagined, could hear him.
You, many saw it. Many saw him, the shield-breaker, glorious Gilgeol. He looked through your eyes, fought with your limbs.
No.
Kumor smiled, then withdrew a circlet woven of thorns and olive sprigs from his voluminous right sleeve. Save for the odd cough, the gathered Enrithi fell absolutely silent. With an old man's unsteady gentleness, he placed the circlet upon Sabon's head. Then stepping back, the high cultist of Gilgeol cried,
Rise, Quaitha Sabon, Prince of Galioth, battle celebrant!
Once again, the assembly thundered in exultation. Sabon pressed himself to his feet, but slowly, like a man wearied by a near heartbreaking run. For a moment, he looked about in disbelief. Then, without warning, he turned to Kellis, his cheeks shining with tears in the firelight. His clean-shaven face still bore cuts and bruises from 5 days previous.
Why? His anguished look said. I don't deserve this.
Kellis smiled sadly and bowed to the precise degree Jinan demanded from all men in the presence of a battle celebrant. He'd more than mastered their brute customs by now. He'd learned the subtle flourishes that transformed the seemly into the august. He knew their every cue. The roaring redoubled. They'd all witnessed their exchanged look. They'd all heard the story of Sabon's pilgrimage to Kellis at the ruined shrine.
It happens, father. It happens.
But the thunderous cheering suddenly faltered, trailed into the rumble of questioning voices. Kellis saw Ikuri Confis standing before the bonfire not far from Sabon, his shouts only now becoming audible.
Fools, he railed. Rank idiots! You'd honor this man? You'd acclaim acts that nearly doomed the entire holy war?
A tide of jeers and taunts swelled through the amphitheater.
Quaitha Sabon, battle celebrant?
Confis cried in derision and somehow managed to silence the rumble.
Fool celebrant, I say. The man who nearly saw all of you killed on these cursed fields. And trust me, this is the one place where you don't want to die.
Sabon simply watched him, dumbstruck.
You know what I mean,
the exalt general said to him directly.
You know what you did was errant folly.
Reflections of the bonfire curled like oil across his golden breastplate. The masses had fallen utterly silent. He had no choice, Kellis knew, but to intervene. Confess is too clever to—
The craven see folly everywhere!
A powerful voice boomed from the lower tiers.
All daring is rash in their eyes, because they would call their cowardice prudence.
Nayur had stood from his place next to Zynemus. Months had passed, and still the Skilvendi's penetration surprised him. Nayur saw the danger, Kellis realized, knew that Sauban would be useless if he were discredited. Confis laughed.
So I'm a coward, am I, Skilvendi?
His right hand happened upon the pommel of his sword.
In a manner,
Nayur said. He wore black breeches and a gray thigh-length vest, plunder from the Kianine camp, that left both his chest and banded arms bare. Firelight shimmered across the vest's silk embroidery, flashed from his pale eyes. As always, the plainsman emanated a feral intensity that made others, Kellis noted, stiffen in inarticulate alarm. Everything about him looked hard, like sinew one had to saw rather than slice.
Since defeating the people, the Skilvendi continued, much glory has been heaped upon your name. Because of this, you begrudge others that same glory. The valor and wisdom of Coetus Sauban have defeated Scaurus. No mean thing, if what you said at your emperor's knee was to be believed. But since this glory is not yours, you think it false. You call it foolishness, blind luck.
It was blind luck, Confis cried. The gods favor the drunk and the soft of head. That's the only lesson we've learned.
I cannot speak to what your gods favor, Nayor replied. But you have learned much, very much. You have learned the Fenum cannot withstand a determined charge by Enrithi knights, nor can they break a determined defense by Enrithi footmen. You have learned the strength and shortcomings of their tactics and their weapons against the heavily armored foe. You have witnessed the limits of their patience, and you have taught as well a very important lesson. You have taught them to fear. Even now in the hills they run like jackals before the wolf.
Cheers spread through the crowds, gradually growing into another deafening roar. Stupefied, Confis stared at the Skilvendi, his fingers kneading his pommel. He'd been roundly defeated, and so swiftly.
Time for another scar on your arms,
someone cried, and laughter boomed through the amphitheater. Nayur graced the assembled Enrithi with a rare, fierce grin. Even from this distance, Kellis knew the exalt general felt neither shame nor embarrassment. The man smiled as though a crowd of lepers had just insulted his beauty. For Confis, the derision of thousands meant as little as the derision of one. The game was all that mattered. Among those Kellis needed to dominate, Aikuri Confis was an especially problematic case. Not only did he suffer pride, almost lunatic in proportion, he possessed a pathological disregard for the estimations of other men. Moreover, like his uncle the Emperor, he believed that Kellis himself was somehow connected to Skaos, to the Kishorum, if a Kamian could be believed. Add to that a childhood surrounded by the labyrinthine intrigues of the Imperial precincts, and the exalt general became almost as immune to Dunyane techniques as the Skilvendi. And he planned, Kellis knew, something catastrophic for the Holy War. Another mystery, another threat. The great names moved on to bicker about further things. First, Proyas, using arguments he'd rehearsed, Kellis surmised, with Nayur, suggested they send a mounted force to Hinnereth with all dispatch, not to take the city, but to secure its surrounding fields before they could be prematurely harvested and sheltered within its walls. The same, he declared, should be done for the entire coastline. Under torment, several Kianine captives had said that Scaurus, as a contingency, had ordered all the winter grains in Gedea harvested as soon as they became milk-ripe. Swearing that the Imperial fleet could supply the Holy War entire, Confis argued against the plan, warning that Scaurus yet possessed the strength and cunning to destroy any such force. Loath to depend on the Emperor in any way, the other great names were disinclined to believe him, however, and it was agreed. Several thousand horsemen would be mustered and sent out on the morrow under Earl Athgieri, Palatine Ingaiaban, and Earl Werigen Greatheart. Then the incendiary issue of the Ainani host Sloth and the constant fragmentation of the Holy War was broached. Here, masked Kefaramuni, who had to answer to the Scarlet Spires, found a surprise ally in Proyas, who argued, with several provisos, that they actually should continue traveling in separate contingents. When the issue threatened to become intractable, he called on Neyur for support, but the Skilvendi's harsh assessment had little effect, and the argument dragged on. The first men of the Tusk continued shouting into the night, growing ever more drunk on the Sapatashah's sweet Umarnan wines. And Kellis studied them, glimpsed depths that would have terrified them had they known. Periodically, he revisited the thing called Sarcellus, who often gazed back as though Kellis were a boy with fine shanks that a wicked shrial knight might love. It taunted him. But such a look was merely a semblance, Kellis knew, as surely as the expressions animating his own face. Still, there could be no doubt, not any longer. They knew Kellis could see them. I must move more quickly, father. The Nilnameshi had it wrong. Mysteries could be killed if one possessed the power. Lounging beneath the bellied crimson canvas of his pavilion, Ikuri Confis spent the first hour verbally entertaining various scenarios involving the Skilvendi's murder. Martimus had said little, and in some infuriated corner of his thoughts, Confis suspected that the drab general not only secretly admired the barbarian, but had thoroughly enjoyed the earlier fiasco in the amphitheater. And yet, by and large, this bothered Confis little, though he couldn't say why. Perhaps, assured of Martimus's actual loyalty, he cared nothing for the man's spiritual infidelities. Spiritual infidelities were as common as dirt. Afterward, he spent another hour telling Martimus what was to happen at Hinnereth. This had lightened his mood greatly. Demonstrations of his brilliance always buoyed his spirits, and his plans for Hinnereth were nothing short of genius. How well it paid to be friends with one's enemies. And so, feeling magnanimous, he decided to open a little door and allow Martimus, easily the most competent and trustworthy of all his generals, into some rather large halls. In the coming months, he would need confidants. All emperors needed confidants. But, of course, prudence demanded certain assurances. Though Martimus was loyal by nature, loyalties were, as the Ainani were fond of saying, like wives. One must always know where they lie, and with absolute certainty. He leaned back into his canvas chair and peered past Martimus to the far side of the pavilion, where the crimson standard of the Overarmy rested in its illumined shrine. His gaze lingered on the ancient Kyranian disc that glinted from the folds, supposedly once the chest piece of some great king's harness. For some reason, the figures stamped there, golden warriors with elongated limbs, had always arrested him. So familiar, and yet so alien.
Have you ever stared at it before, Martimus? I mean, truly stared?
For a moment, the general looked as though he might be too far into his cups, but only for a moment. The man never truly got drunk.
The concubine? He asked.
Confis smiled pleasantly. Common soldiers commonly referred to the overstandard as the concubine, because tradition demanded it be quartered with the exalt general. Confis had always found the name particularly amusing. He'd drawn his cock across that hallowed silk more than once. A strange feeling to spill one's seed on the sacred. Quite delicious.
Yes, he said. The concubine.
The general shrugged.
What officer hasn't?
And how about the tusk? Have you ever laid eyes upon it?
Martimus raised his brows.
Yes.
Really?
Confis exclaimed. He himself had never seen the tusk.
When was that?
As a boy, back when Salis II was Shrier. My father brought me with him to Sumna to visit his brother, my uncle, who for a time was an orderly in the Junrayuma. He took me to see it.
Did he now? What did you think?
The general stared into his wine bowl, which he held poised between his wonderfully thick fingers.
Hard to remember. Or, I think. Or? I remember my ears ringing. I shook, I know that. My uncle told me I should be afraid, that the tusk was connected to far bigger things.
The general smiled, fixing Confis with his clear brown eyes.
I asked him if he meant a mastodon, and he swatted me right there in the presence of the holiest of holies. Confis affected amusement. The holiest of holies. He took a long sip of his wine, savored the warm, almost buzzing taste. Many years had passed since he'd last enjoyed Scaurus's private stock. He could still scarcely believe the old jackal had been bested, and by Coithus Sabon. He'd meant what he'd said earlier. The gods did favor the soft of head. Men like Confis, on the other hand, they tested. Men like themselves.
Tell me, Martimus, if you had to die defending one or the other, the concubine or the tusk, which would it be?
The concubine, the general replied without a whisper of hesitation.
And why's that?
Again, the general shrugged. Habit. Confis fairly howled.
Now that was funny. Habit? What more assurance could a man desire?
Dear man, precious man. He paused, collected himself for a moment, then said,
This man, Prince Kellis of Atrithau, what do you make of him?
Martimus scowled, then leaned forward in his chair. Confis had once made a game of this, leaning forward and back and watching the way Martimus's pose answered his, as though some critical distance between their faces must always be observed. In some ways, Martimus was such a strange man.
Intelligent, the general said after a moment. Well-spoken and utterly impoverished.
Why do you ask? Still hesitant, Confis appraised his subordinate for a moment. Martimus was unarmed, as was custom when conferring alone with members of the imperial family. He wore only a plain red smock. He cares nothing about impressing me. This, Confis reminded himself, was what made his opinion so invaluable.
I think it's time I told you a little secret, Martimus. Do you remember Scaeus?
The Emperor's prime counsel. What of him?
He was a spy. A Kisharum spy. My uncle, ever keen to confirm his fears, noted that Prince Kellis seemed peculiarly interested in Scaeus during that final gathering of the great names on the Andiamine Heights. Our emperor, as you know, is not one to idly brood over his suspicions.
Martimus blanched with shock. For a moment, it looked his nose might fall off his face. Confis could almost read his thoughts.
Scaeus, a Kisharum spy? This is a little secret? So Scaeus admitted working for the Kisharum?
The exalt general shook his head.
He didn't need to. He was some kind of abomination, a faceless abomination, and of a species the Imperial Sake couldn't detect, which means, of course, he must have been Kisharum. Faceless?
Confis blinked, and for the thousandth time saw Scaeus's oh-so-familiar face unclutch.
Don't ask me to explain, I cannot.
Fucking words.
So you think this Prince Kellis is a Kisharum spy as well? A contact of some kind?
He's something, Martimus. Just what remains to be seen. The general's astonished expression suddenly hardened into something shrewd.
Like the Emperor, you're not one to harbor idle suspicions, Lord Exalt General.
True, Martimus. But unlike my uncle, I know the wisdom of staying my hand, of letting my enemies think I'm deceived. To observe, and to observe closely, is not to remain idle.
But this is my point, Martimus said. Surely you've purchased informants. Surely you've had the man watched. What have you learned so far?
Surely.
Not much. He camps with a Skilvendi, seems to share a woman with him. Quite a beauty, I'm told. He spends his days with a schoolman named Drusus Sarkamion, the same mandate fool my uncle contracted to corroborate the Imperial Sake regarding Scaeus, though whether this is anything more than a coincidence, I don't know. Supposedly, they talk history and philosophy. He belongs, like the Skilvendi, to Proyas's inner circle, and he wields, as fairly the entire Holy War witnessed tonight, some kind of strange power over Sorbonne. Otherwise, the caste menials seem to think he's a poor man's prophet, a seer or something.
Not much, Martimus exclaimed.
From your description, he sounds like a man of power to me. Frightful power, if he belongs to the Kisharum.
Confis smiled. Growing power. He leaned forward, and sure enough, Martimus leaned back.
Would you like to know what I think?
Of course.
I think he's been sent by the Kisharim to infiltrate and destroy the Holy War. Sorbonne's idiotic march and that nonsense about punishing the Shrile Knights was simply his first attempt. Mark me, there will be another. He bewitches men somehow, plays the prophet.
Martimus narrowed his eyes and shook his head. But I've heard quite the opposite. They say he denies those who make more of him than he is.
Confis laughed. Is there any better way to posture as a prophet? People don't like the smell of presumption, Martimus. Even the pig castes have noses as keen as wolves when it comes to those who claim to be more. Me, on the other hand, I quite like the savory stink of gall. I find it honest.
Martimus's face darkened.
Why are you telling me this?
Always to the quick, eh, General? Small wonder I find you so refreshing.
Small wonder, the man repeated. Such a dry wit, Martimus.
Confis reached for the decanter and refilled his bowl with more of the Sepatashah's wine.
I tell you this, Martimus, because I would have you play general in a different sort of war. Quite against all reason, you've become a man of power. If this Prince Kellis collects followers to a purpose, if he courts the mighty, then you should prove well-nigh irresistible.
A pained expression crept into Martimus's face. You want me to play disciple?
Yes, Confis replied. I do not like the smell of this man.
Then why not just have him killed?
But of course. How could he be so penetrating and so dense by turns? The exalt general inclined his bowl and watched the blood-dark wine roll in the bottom. For an instant, its bouquet transported him back years to his days as a hostage in Scaurus's opulent court. He glanced once again to the overstandard behind its curtain of incense, his sweet concubine.
It's strange, Confis said. But I feel young.